in the last bit of Mark 11. And we're going to start in verse 27 here. So if you want to turn there with me, we're going to read. So they came again to Jerusalem, and he was walking in the temple. The chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to him and began saying to him, "By what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority to do these things?" And Jesus said to them, "I will ask you one question, and you answer me, and then I will tell you what authority I do these things. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from men? Answer me." So they began reasoning among themselves, saying, "Well, if we say from heaven, he will say, 'Then why did you not believe in him?' But shall we say from men?" They were afraid of the people, for everyone considered John to have been a real prophet. Answering Jesus, they said, "We do not know." And Jesus said to them, "Nor will I tell you by what authority I do these things." So let's think about the situation that's happening here. This is the last week. This is the Passover week. So there's just not a few people around. There are thousands and thousands of people here during this time. And they approach Jesus with a question about authority. They want to know about his authority. What's their motive behind this question? Do they really truly want to know where his authority is from? They don't, do they? They're looking to trap him once again, are they not? Because what happens if he says, "My authority is from God"? They're going to accuse him of what? Blasphemy. They are looking to trip him up. But he turns the tables on them and says, "What? Answer me this." And he puts them, it puts the question right back on them. Because if they say this, that John's baptism was from God, then why didn't you follow me? But if you say the opposite, they lose the people. And that was their biggest fear. They needed to remove Jesus from the scene because they were losing their authority, their population, or the popularity, and their rule with the people. Because in the first part of this, in which it says they came to him and said, "By what authority are you doing these things?" Well, what are these things? What had he just done? He had cleansed the temple. What else he had done in Mark's account where it talks about he actually blocked them from bringing things in and out of the temple in the section he was in. He blocked it. And so we see in this section the question was about authority because they wanted to know from what rabbinical authority do you have this? Who taught you? And they knew he didn't have any rabbis that taught him from the way he taught. And we've looked at this from the beginning of Mark when the people were amazed at his authority of his teaching. They were amazed at his authority over demons and evil spirits and his authority over to forgive sin. So we've seen it over and over in the book of Mark. So their motive was far beyond of wanting to know where his authority was. Any comments or questions about that particular section? All right. I know we're kind of going rapidly because we're trying to get through this. I have a goal of getting there. So we're going to go to Mark chapter 12 here. And we're going to look at the first 12 verses here. But as we get into this particular part of Mark, we're going to see a section here of judgment. That's a story about judgment. And then we're going to see this follows up with three different conversations. We're going to see a conversation, one that targets with the Pharisees and the Herodians. We're going to see another one that's with the Sadducees, and then again with the scribes. And this is kind of the final, in a sense, collision with these particular leaders from the standpoint before the trial and before the crucifixion. But understanding this and what's happening here, and thinking about the scenario and what situation Jesus is in this last week of his life, think about it from the perspective of Jesus. He lived with perfect understanding that the cross is coming. It's on its way. Keep that in the back of your minds with this situation, with everything that's happening this week, that he knows that the cross had to be. He knows it's a reality. And then as we look at this story here in Mark chapter 12, this story is really, it's designed to escalate their hostility towards him, because this is the final week. And when you think about the big picture and the fullness of time and God's timing, keep that in the back of your minds as well, because God's timing is perfect, because it escalates really fast here. So let's look at the first 12 verses here. And he began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a vat under the wine press and built a tower and rented it out to the vine growers and went on a journey. And at the harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order to receive some of the produce from the vineyard and from the vine growers. They took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And again, he sent them another slave, and they wounded him in the head and treated him shamefully, and sent him another, and he sent another, and one they killed. And so with many others beating some and killing others, he had one more to send, a beloved son. He sent him last of all to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But those vine growers said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and inheritance will be ours." They took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the vine growers, and he will give the vineyard to others. Have you not even read the scripture? The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. This came about from the Lord, and it is marvelous in our eyes. And they were seeking to seize him, and yet they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke the parable against them. And so they left him and went away. So this is one of those parables we don't have to really realize who we're talking about here. He's pretty straightforward, is he not? So who planted the vineyard? God. Who were the vine growers? The religious leaders. And the journey he speaks of, I believe he's talking about the period of the Old Testament, the time. And the harvest time was what? What would be the reference to the harvest time? What does God expect at a harvest? Fruit. What did he expect from the Jews? What would he have expected from his people? Yes. Keep the big context. This has all been going on in a very short period of time, but remember the fig tree of what should be producing. And who were the slaves? The prophets. I heard someone say it. He sent one after another, after another, after another. And surely they won't reject his son. And who is his son? It's Jesus. And then the question comes in verse 9. What will the owner of the vineyard do? That's the question right there. What will he do? What's that? He's going to take the vineyard away. He is. In Matthew 21:41, the people answered and said, "Bring those wretches to a wretched end." They knew exactly what needed to be done. And he goes on. And it says here at the end in chapter 12, or in verse 12, that he knew they were speaking of him. Or they knew that Jesus was speaking of them, the religious leaders. How would they have known? How would they have known? Did they know? Did they remember that they were responsible for mistreating the prophets? I think it's interesting. I mean, you could go back in Jeremiah 7 and 25, and you can talk about the mistreatment of that. But if you go to Matthew 23 for just a second, Matthew, the 23rd chapter, and this is the woe to you, a lot of woes to you, but in verse 29, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous and say, well, if we had been living in those days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are the sons who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of guilt of your fathers. They admitted that their forefathers were the ones who destroyed the prophets. They knew exactly who he was referring to. They were guilty of shedding the prophets' blood. And they're doing it again and again. But yet, it doesn't stop them. And it just makes me think of just how much authority and power people strive for. And that's what they could not let go. Not only that, they could not let go of what their perception of what the kingdom was going to be as well. So they're dealing with both things. But they were so blinded of their perception and so blinded of that they were these chosen people. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the council, all of them, that they just missed the point. And they were so, so hung up on that, they didn't even want to hear the truth in so much of this. And they understood in verse 12 that they spoke the parable against them. But that's not the end of this parable, because he goes on and says what in verse 10? He says that the stone which the builders rejected. This is a quote from Psalm 118, and it's the foreshadowing and its prophecy being fulfilled. The one you reject will come back as the cornerstone. And we see this over and over in New Testament passages in Acts 4:11, that Jesus is the cornerstone, in 1 Peter 2:6 through 8, Romans 9:32 and 33, Ephesians 2:20. There's just multiple passages that we're all very familiar with, that Jesus is the cornerstone. Any thoughts or comments as we look at this particular? He also talks about, Luke adds an interesting part of this story where Luke adds something where it says, another part of Psalm 19, Jesus says, everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and whoever it falls, it will scatter him like dust. It's an interesting aspect to add to the story when you think about the stone and Jesus being the chief cornerstone, because anyone who comes into contact with Jesus, they will either be broken of their pride and their self-will and themselves, but those who refuse will be crushed by the stone. And that was a common rabbi teaching, is the stone will crush. And you can see that over and over. They talked about the rabbis used a stone. If a stone falls on a pot, it will crush the pot. If a pot falls on the stone, it will shatter the pot. Either way, whether the pot falls on the stone or the stone falls, the result is the same. So we see in this story the envious jealousy of the Pharisees, who's threatened with their authority and their power, and the realization that Jesus is speaking of them, and the blasphemy they accuse him or did not accuse him of. Thoughts or comments about this particular section about the vineyard owner? Yes.
The only thing that I would say is the answer to the question is the previous section, and they understand the answer.
From
by what authority do you do this? And basically it says there's a guy who had a vineyard and he was God and he had a son. That's what
he did. Yeah. Use the story to teach. Yes. Yes, sir. When he gets down to verse 9, oh, and he will give the vineyard to others. My thought is that it will be given to others. And I think it's foreshadowing that, yes, when day of Pentecost and when on the resurrection and the new, it's open to all, is my thoughts on that.
Don't you think that could also be referring to opening up to the Gentiles?
Yes, that's what I was referring to. And it could be, too. One commentary is that the authority is also going to be given to the apostles here soon. And they'll have the authority to this part.
Well, to that point, God always desires fruit. And this parable and other, where he uses vineyards, fig, and Paul uses the same argument here, to your point in Romans chapter 11, where he talks to the Gentiles, and he says there in verse 21, "For God has not spared the natural branches, neither will he spare you. Note then the kindness and the severity of God, the severity toward those who have fallen, but God's kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness, otherwise you too will be cut off." I find it interesting, Paul's argument to the Gentile Christians there in Romans is this is not just what we just read about, it's not just for the Jews and how they rejected, but there's a warning to us as well too, that we have been grafted in, but only if we follow his commandments and are honest with ourselves, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a lesson. Sometimes we're so harsh on the Pharisees and we go, look, there's a lesson for us to do this. God always desires fruit. He always wants his children to produce that.
Yeah. We're hard on the Pharisees, and I mean, and I'm not trying to give them a pass, but I mean, we always say, well, if I was there, I wouldn't have done that. Well, they said the same thing. So, yes.
This wouldn't have been a new parable for them. Isaiah actually describes something very close to this in Isaiah 5. And the whole point, really, to Isaiah 5 is God has built the vineyard. He has cultivated the vineyard. The vineyard is not producing. I'll tell you what he's going to do. He's going to rip up the vineyard. And he's going to do that in judgment, if you will, of that. To add some of the components to this, I think, just illustrate that not only have you been given that vineyard, but you have been given a responsibility. Whether these are the leaders, which I tend to think it is, or whether you just say that this is a responsibility that people were given, I think it's the same result. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. And not only are you not doing it, but you're killing people coming that are coming to tell you what you're supposed to be doing. So it wasn't something new that they wouldn't have heard or known, especially the scribes and Pharisees.
And they were very familiar with the passage in Isaiah 5. And that's exactly how another reason they knew it was from this. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to look at this, and I mean, not that none of these are right or wrong. I mean, I don't have a problem with them, but you can get really. I mean, you can sometimes dissect these things so much. Yes, sir.
Look at the central theme in a parable. An allegory is
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. We're going to, yes, sir. I'm sorry, John. I did not hear. I hear a scratching.
This commentary says that as a baseline, Jerusalem's destruction in AD 70 may well be a partial fulfillment of this statement.
Yes. I mean, he's trying to get them to understand all this physical stuff, all these different things, it's going to be gone. And we're going to get it. And in a minute, he's going to go back to the heart of the matter. Or they're going to ask, what's the greatest commandment? And we've talked about in the past, what has God always wanted? The heart. They were so caught up on the physical aspect of things. All right, we're going to go on here. So we're going to come into the question of taxes. It's titled in my... But here's what I was talking about earlier. Here's our first encounter, and this is going to be with the Pharisees and the Herodians. So they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to him in order to trap him in a statement. They came and said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are truthful and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth." Boy, they're really buttering up. Lord, you only speak the truth. You always speak the truth. You don't have to refer or talk to anyone because you know it all. "Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? Still we pay... Or shall we pay, or shall we not pay?" But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, "Why are you testing me? Bring me a denarius to look at." And they brought one. And he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And they said to him, "Caesar's." And he said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they were amazed at him. All right, so here we see this first encounter after this, the Pharisees and the Herodians. It's funny how you bring two groups of people who don't like each other. They're coming together now to come after Jesus here. And the key is their hypocrisy here, and it's on full display. The people are trying to do what? If he says, pay taxes, the people that are following him, they're going to be like, why are we giving to this heathen government? So they're looking to discredit him with the population of the Jews from that standpoint. But then the Herodians are there. They're the political side. Well, if he says, don't pay, wait a second. He's trying to create a political movement here. We got to stop it. So either way, they're trying to trap him. Are they not? They're trying to trap Jesus here. It's interesting as you bring in Matthew and Luke's account, but Luke 20:20, it says, at that moment, some of the Pharisees and Herodians arrived in front of Jesus, and it says they were spies who pretended to be righteous. So they're taking every angle to try to trap Jesus here. So the Pharisees want to get rid of Jesus because of his theology, but that wasn't good enough. That wasn't going to cut it with the Romans. But the Romans weren't going to kill Jesus for saying he's the Son of God. So they want the Herodians to pull in and say, well, you know what? We'll get him to say he is creating an open rebellion against Rome because he's telling people, don't pay taxes, don't pay taxes. And that's not what Jesus is saying. So what does Jesus say? He says, pay the tax. Why? Exactly. Are we using that coin? I mean, well, and we can look at passages in the New Testament to submit to the civil government and things like that. And did they not get benefit of water ducts and protection and roads and things like that? They're using things from things that Rome had done, right? Give to God or give to Caesar what is Caesar's. But give God to God is his. The things of, yes. What are the things of God? That's a great question. What does he want? What does he want from us? Very much so. Very much so. Yes.
The intention was wrong with this question, but this is an answer I'm glad I have. Because I think one of the things that as a Christian, I mean, would I respond to military conscription? I think this is a passage that I would point to and say, yeah, that is something that would be my duty. Because I think a Christian's dual citizenship in the United States and in heaven has divided loyalties that you have to reconcile. And what Jesus does pretty concisely here is he starts drawing a line for us. And basically, I think you're making exactly the right point, which is God wants your character. God wants who you are. And your service is to the country that you live in. And he will make a very similar point when he sends them to Babylon and say, you know, root for the local team. Build a house, have a family, and you need to support the local community, but don't forget your mom.
Yeah. Has God not ordained civil authority? You know, one of the thoughts that came to my mind was what happened in Daniel chapter 4 with Nebuchadnezzar, one of the most powerful men of that time. God sent him and turned him into a beast for 7 years, basically. And he comes back and realizes what? He knew that the Most High reigns in heaven and gives kingdoms to those whom he wills. He realized that God rules among the kingdoms of men, did he not? So, back to his question, what do we owe God? Verse 17. Jesus said, and render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God the things of the God. He wants us. He wants our hearts. He wants our soul. He wants our mind and our strength. And we owe that because what has he given us? He's given us his son, has he not? The son who is about to be put upon a cross and crucified for all. And they were missing the point. Any other comments or questions? I know we're going fast, and I'm skipping through notes here. Yes, Will.
It says, verse 17, things of God to God. I think you very well could be alluding to the fact that on this denarius, this is very good evidence, the denarii minted in Syria, which has been used in Israel, that it had Caesar's picture on it, but it also referred to him as a god on the throne. So I think he's saying, okay, pay the tax to Caesar, but also remember, he's not really God, even though it says it on the coin. I think that's legitimate.
No, that's an excellent point. That is. I'm running out of time, so I'm going through notes. Yes, sir. God is much bigger and greater. Yes, sir.
Apologize in advance for further derailing this on the social issues, but I feel like it's maybe important.
Okay.
So, like you mentioned, military service, and that's a hot button issue among Christians, and I don't want to stir the pot on that, but I do believe that it's possible to peacefully opt out. If your conscience prevents you from joining a military effort where you know people are getting killed and you do not believe that you should contribute to the killing of other people, then I think Christians should be able to opt out of the service, but should be very prepared to deal with the consequences. To get thrown in jail or to be labeled an expatriate or whatever happens. But I think we have the freedom to listen to our conscience and disobey the law when it troubles that, but we also have to be fully prepared to deal with the consequences the government might throw at us as a result of this. Father Stewart, I'm now done.
No, and I'm... I am going to move along, but I'm not to ignore that, but it's just...
You can ignore it.
You really don't want me to get through this chapter.
I don't. We're going to spend the rest of the time on Mark 11.
All right. We're not ignoring that, but we're going to keep scooting here, okay? Where am I? Okay. The question of the resurrection... All right, we're running out of time, and I don't have time to read this, but this is the Sadducees. Here's the interesting part about this. The Sadducees are coming to him on this. We had the Pharisees and the Herodians come together, and here's the Sadducees now. And they're bringing up the question about the resurrection, and they give this long, drawn-out, wild scenario of the seven. We're familiar with it. We've talked about it. Okay, what's interesting? Did the Sadducees even believe in the resurrection? No, I agree. Everything I read, they don't believe in this resurrection, did they? It's another trap. That's exactly right. Don't forget the situation here. This is Passover week. Thousands and thousands of people. And they are slowly seeing the crowds gravitate more and more and more towards Jesus. This is not what they want. Their goal is to discredit Jesus with the people. Him with the people. And have the people turn on him. And that's what they're trying to do. Is catching him in these dilemmas or these traps. So we see the Sadducees coming to him and bringing back passages all the way back from Deuteronomy 25:25. And he answers them, number one, you don't understand the scriptures. Secondly, he says, you also don't understand the power of God. And what he explains to them in verse 25, for when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. Not our angels, but like angels. We don't know exactly what that is, but... And when they rise, in the parallel passage, Luke 20:34, the sons of this age, when the people in this world rise from the dead to the next life, they'll neither marry or be given in marriage. So that's Luke's account and Mark's account here. So in earthly terms, in earthly relationships, we see there are terms of time and place, which means a man can be a son and then an adult and then a husband and then a father and so on and so on. But in heaven, all that changes. We don't have all those roles anymore. That's no longer. But they're hung up on this. And it's interesting that he answers them with the response of this in the Exodus 3:6, because they didn't believe in the resurrection, because they only looked at the first five books, the Pentateuch, and they never could find where resurrection would be. But here, listen to this. He says to them, Exodus 3:6, I am the God, and in this passage he's quoting here in Mark, I am the God of Abraham, I am the God of Isaac, I am the God of Jacob. Now get that. He speaks of this covenant relationship with the patriarchs who aren't around anymore. They have all died, and he says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, not I was, and they were. He says, I am. It doesn't say I was the God of Isaac, the God of Abraham, or the God of Jacob. Which means what? There's some resurrection. There's identification there in the present tense. And in the first five books, which they only reference in Exodus chapter 3 here, they would have been dead at that point, would they have not? Because those are only five books that they recognize and couldn't, or they didn't see that there was a resurrection. So he answers their question by showing them right there, I'm not the God of who were, who's not anymore, but he uses the present tense. He still is the God. I thought that I'd never seen or heard that until I was reading some different explanations, thoughts or comments on that particular aspect.
Once I die, God is still my God.
Always.
He always will and was and will
Still is. Most definitely. And then we come to the next section. The next group, which is the scribes, come to him. And this is the question of the greatest commandments. And we've kind of talked about this a few chapters ago about loving God. And he had always wanted the men or the people's heart. And that hasn't changed. So as you look at this, he asked the question here in verse 26. One of the scribes came and heard the arguing and recognizing he had answered them and well, and he asked him, what commandment is the foremost of all? All right, what's the greatest commandment, or what's of foremost of all? And we've been talking about how they're trying to entrap Jesus. How would that question entrap Jesus? What would be the trap there? Because they're seeking to trap him.
But I think this guy recognizes that he's shutting everybody up, and he has a question, and he wants to know the answer to it.
He was sent, but if you look at the other accounts, they had plotted and they sent this man. So where I think, I agree, but I also think that when I've read this, that they're looking for, where is he going to disagree with Moses? Because they looked at Moses from a standpoint of one of the prophets that brought the law. They're looking to where they're trying to trap him in where the law is when you look at these accounts.
You're right, teacher. You got it right.
Oh, he does right. And then we go on and see in the rest, which looks like Michael's going to handle for us coming up, but yes. But I still think that these people, motive, I don't think we can see it. They have spent countless secrecy, and in public trying to entrap Jesus so that he can no longer have the popularity. But this is all in God's timing, because this is exactly what God would know would happen. It's the fullness of time. And this is the week where it all has to happen, where it escalates to the point where they get him to the point of crucifixion. And that's where we're heading. Thank you for your kind attention and your comments.